From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Something happened to Eric Vance when he was a young boy. He was very sick, and his parents were convinced he had contracted Legionnaire's disease. There had been an outbreak that year. Long story short, he got better, and his parents, who were Christian scientists, believed God had healed him. Vance is a science writer these days, and for years he's been trying to figure out what actually happened to him all those years ago. Because he says he's not satisfied with the usual responses to stories of healing, either that there are forces we don't understand or the mind is a powerful thing. Vance says, yes, those statements are true, but they shouldn't be good enough for any of us. Not now, not with what we're learning about how our brains actually work. So that's what the show is about today, what faith and spirituality look like on a brain scan and how they affect our bodies. Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West's podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, providing wealth management to the Intermountain West for over 30 years. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last week, a group of researchers at the University of Utah got a lot of attention for a paper they had published that revealed certain parts of the brains of devout Mormons light up when they have a strong spiritual feeling, when they feel the spirit, as they say. But that was really only one part of a much larger study. A few years ago, the scientists started what they call their Religious Brain Project. And they're trying to figure out what's happening in the brain when people say they're having a religious experience. Does one brand of religion or belief activate different parts of different people's brains, for example? That's a question they try to get at. Does the brain see a difference between feeling the spirit and feeling something else pleasurable? And here's another question that may be hard for a scientist to answer. If there's some biological, physiological explanation for something like spirituality, does that make it seem less miraculous or more? Today in the program, we're exploring how faith affects the chemistry in the human brain. Joining us first is Dr. Jeffrey Anderson. He's a neuroradiologist at the University of Utah, one of the researchers I just mentioned. He's also an associate professor of radiology at the School of Medicine here at the school. It's part of that Religious Brain Project I mentioned. And the paper, by the way, the lead author was Michael Ferguson. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. It was published in the journal Social Neuroscience. And Dr. Jeffrey Anderson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much. Delighted to be here.
What do you make of the reaction? People have been there's kind of a novelty to it, so I'm guessing that probably doesn't surprise you, but people are really interested in this, it seems.
Well, there's a difference. There's tabloid headlines, and then there's a bigger response, people that are really interested in the broader questions, and that's kind of exciting to hear the dialogue, all the different voices about the study.
What interests you about this? Like, what if you were to sort of get to the core of what is it, the thing that you want to understand through all of this? How would you explain it?
Well, what I've wanted to understand all my life are big questions about what it means to be human, to have deep feelings and experiences, and how do our brains help shape those?
Do you think, and I'll come back to this, but there was that question that I posed there in the introduction. If there's a biological explanation, does it mean then that there's no deeper sort of supernatural connect? Do you know what I mean? Like, how do you think about that question? Oh, if we've now figured out, oh, no, it's a thing that's going on in the brain, can't be God. I mean, how do you think about that? Or how do you think about the way others are thinking about that question?
Well, imagine, for example, that you're in an art museum staring at a beautiful piece of art, and you realize that something is happening in your brain as you're having those perceptions and you know, this amazing deep thoughts and experiences you're having. Well, does that detract from the experience itself of looking at the art? I don't think so. In some ways, it adds another dimension to it. And I think people have always known that religious and spiritual experiences inside of our brains are, to some extent, part of the biology, you know, that there's something happening inside of the brain. And when you actually say, yes, in fact, there is something happening and it's here, Well, that kind of makes it more real, and I think that's what people are wrestling with.
One of the respondents in the study, she was quoted in the Salt Lake Tribune, her name escapes me right now, but she mentioned when she saw these different parts of her brain lighting up when she was having this spiritual experience as part of the study, she said, oh, there's physical evidence. She described it as physical evidence for something. What did you make of that?
I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, there's this validation, a sense of I have these feelings and they're real to me, but to have something objective, tangible, measurable that is associated with it, well, I think to some people that can be validating.
You've talked about, I want to ask you about the project itself, because you've said you were kind of waiting for all of the pieces to sort of fall into place. And then all of a sudden you said, you put it this way to us earlier in the week, lightning struck, like something came together. What was it that came together that got you really going on?
Well, two things. So one was the tools have matured. So over just in the last few years, we have new brain imaging tools that we didn't have before. And the second thing was the team. So this is not the work of any one person. I mean, there's some really talented scientists that I've had the opportunity to work with. I mean, Michael Ferguson, Jared Nielsen, Julie Korenberg, and so many others that have complementary expertise. And it just happened. We all came together and said, it's time to try this pilot project.
You should point out how precise this imagery can be. Like, one of the things I've heard you talk about is that you can sort of detect, I don't know how micro it gets, but just the smallest level of blood flow that's changing. You can get pretty precise with your instruments these days.
Yes, we can measure changes on the order of about a millimeter.
Wow. Why do you figure that there's so little information about the neuroscience of spirituality and religion? You've talked about how it's in some ways completely unknown. Was it just because we didn't have the instruments to figure it out, or do you think there's something else going on?
Well, people have tried. You know, there is a small literature, dating back a decade or two, and it's certainly a question of interest to people, but I think there's a combination of a lot of factors. So most of our funding agencies in science deal with health, and rightly so. Yeah. And yet these questions that I think have huge social impact, that affect the lives of billions of people, are daunting to try and undertake. It's hard to get a handle on where to start. Sometimes it's like a great big tapestry where you can't really see what all of the components are and until you get a thread or something and you realize, oh, well, this is what it's made out of. And you can pull at that thread and before long you can disassemble. Now, that's not what we're aiming to do. I mean, it's more like maybe trying to take apart a car or a machine and then put it back together and see what the parts are.
But what good does that do? All right, we now know that when this woman is watching a talk on Mormon General Conference, parts of her brain are lighting up, and it's the similar kind of thing that's lighting up for other experiences, but it's lighting up. But what? What can we do with that? And not that we have to have any sort of practical application of it, but how do you think about that?
Well, I think it has implications. So when you understand how something works in the brain, it gives it context. And you can start to think about questions like, well, how do religious beliefs and convictions come to form in the first place? How are they maintained? How does it affect our social behavior? Are there ways of looking at unhealthy religious practices that have huge social impact? Everything from unhealthy attachments to religious leaders, to religiously motivated violence. And, these are related questions on some level.
Yeah. I want to come back to that question of what it is you're seeing if there's a difference. I saw this question put to you by an Al Jazeera piece. They were looking at your work and they asked you this question. Is there a difference in the brain scan between Mother Teresa and a terrorist, for example?
Yeah, wow, what a profound question.
Right?
And we don't know.
Yeah.
We ultimately don't know. But when you start to place constraints on where these types of experiences are in the brain, then you can suggest mechanisms for both healthy and unhealthy types of practices associated with religion.
Mm. I want to ask you, it's interesting, Eric Vance, who's going to join us later on the program, he's written this cover article for the National Geographic that looks at science and healing and how the brain works, you know, how religious faith informs, you know, healing in the body. There's an interesting connection there. And he's written this book about it as well. And he comes at it from a kind of personal angle. He grew up as a Christian Scientist. His parents were convinced he was healed at a young age. Now, you were raised LDS.
I was.
As I understand that, you're no longer a believer in sort of, I suppose, the conventional sense. So I'm wondering how your experience, to the degree you feel free talking about it, is informing, if it's informing it at all, your sort of what you're trying to get out of this
yeah.
science.
Well, I think that's true for many of us on the study team. So we have a diverse viewpoints.
Yeah.
I mean, the scientists on our study include scientists who are active Mormon, who are ex-Mormon, who are Jewish, who are agnostic, who have different viewpoints, and all those voices are important. And I think personally, I think one of the things that our study has shown is that when you approach something as complex as spiritual experience, you have to come at it from an ecological perspective. And what I mean by that is you have to target a specific type of experience in a specific group of people. And that means understanding something about what you're trying to study.
Yeah.
And, you know, these types of experiences I felt. You know, they're powerful, they're moving, feelings of peace, joy, love. It's such a memorable feeling. And I think to design an appropriate experiment to test that in a laboratory, you have to have some familiarity with what you're looking for. Even more, I think that if you're really wanting to study spirituality, I think that you really have to know something about what that means to people, to society, to really be able to answer important questions.
And I guess it helped that there was some familiarity on the study team for what Mormons mean by feeling the spirit. I mean, because you had to construct a study that got them to feel it in some way.
Right. We weren't sure how participants would translate those
yeah.
feelings to a laboratory, especially to an MRI scanner.
Exactly.
So this is a loud, artificial type of environment, and yet it's also a very private place where people can be alone with their thoughts. And we were really surprised at the extent to which our participants reported feeling something really powerful. I mean, many of them were in tears at the end of the scan.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah,
you said
really
it was
did.
A pretty intense experience for some
It did.
People.
And, we had extensive sessions afterward with the participants where we would talk about what feelings they had, have them describe in their own words. And it seemed like that their descriptions were that it was very similar to private religious practice or an intense worship service.
I wonder when someone is having – when you're able to then – have a study subject in the MRI chamber, and they're having this religious experience. Just give me a sort of basic sense of what is happening in their brain. What's I know a lot of things are happening, but help me understand what's lighting up and what that tells us.
So a lot.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that I think has gotten lost in some of the media attention and sound bites is that this is a complex response. You know, we identify 14 different brain regions, 7 in each hemisphere, that are reproducibly activated, associated with spiritual experience. And so in some ways, it's kind of like a chef creating a complex gourmet dish where you can taste the ingredients, the basil, the oregano, but yet the final product is something different from just the ingredients themselves. In some way, it's emergent, or that there's something that's more than the sum of the parts that make it up. So all of these different brain regions have very interesting associations. Now, it's difficult to say this is what this brain region is doing in this experience. It's a well-known problem called reverse inference. But what we can say is that in other contexts, these brain regions are some of the most complex areas in the brain. They process things like moral reasoning, logic, pattern recognition, working memory, an appreciation of novelty or salience, attention.
Social function, empathy, internal narrative. I mean, the list I've seen, but this raised a question for me. It seems like pretty much everything is lighting up in these scans. Like if everything's lighting up, how are you going to be able to tease out that? I mean, if on one hand you're seeing pattern recognition, abstract thought, judgment, moral reasoning, how can you tease out that that's a religious sort of experience?
Right. Well, when we just look at the brain scans, we don't know. Now, yet not everything is lighting up, though, too.
Okay.
So
What's not?
Well, sensory regions. We don't see visual parts of the brain. We don't see auditory cortex. We don't see... This is not perception.
Sure.
We don't see...
Oh, that's interesting.
We don't see, you know, motor or motor planning regions. We don't see areas of the brain that are related to sensory integration. And I think that what is perhaps even more interesting than the particular brain regions are how they might differ from individual to individual, because that might shape the spiritual experience and, in our study, in fact, correlated with moral values.
Is it subjective, though?
Well, what we saw was that, for example, the insula, this is an area that very complex. It deals with social cognition, empathy, and it differed in how much that area was active across our participants. And the subjects who had more activation there had different responses on questionnaires about what they valued most in terms of their moral worldview.
One of the things about the Al Jazeera piece I found really interesting is you had two of the reporters who came. One was an ex-Mormon, by the way. That's pretty interesting. And then the other was, I'm not sure where she fits sort of ideologically or in her thinking, but she's, you know, a scientist, so was not raised in a religious way. What did you see in their brains?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we are able to image and then ask questions about...
Can I just underline that idea that you saw nothing? Because if you look at the Latter-day Saints, the active Latter-day Saints, their scans were lighting up like Christmas trees. These two ladies, when I saw the scan, it's like nothing going on.
Yeah, well, part of that is kind of technical. So how we do the experiment is we ask... after, you know, each little question or stimulus, how much are you feeling the spirit? And so what we're doing is using a subject as their own control.
Sure.
We're finding points of time when they are feeling the spirit more compared to when they are feeling it less. Now, if somebody reports just not feeling anything at all, then we have nothing to compare. So we really, it's not that nothing is happening in their brain. It's just that we just have no signal.
Yeah. I want to come back to this question. Because does it feel the same for someone contemplating religious violence as it does for the person contemplating religious altruism? That is the reward circuitry the same? Did you answer that question?
No. I think it's a huge question.
And huge.
The bigger question, in fact, is how much do we have a shared library of brain responses across faith traditions, across individuals? How much is in common when people report some transcendent or spiritual experience? And we're just barely starting to get to that information now. You know, early studies were so limited in terms of the methods and the tools, but these questions can be asked now. We could study, you know, Catholics with rosary beads, Muslims in prayer, evangelicals in some kind of ecstatic religious experience, and see how much common ground is there, because there are likely to be differences, and those differences may be really important in terms of what impact that has on their behavior.
Let me, we're essentially out of time, but I want to get to a couple of things that relate to some of the other papers that you're preparing as part of the project. One of the things that was really interesting to me was I guess it's a preliminary finding in one of the papers, that different regions of the brain are engaged with people who value empathy as opposed to loyalty.
Yeah.
Can you say anything about that? I just am really intrigued by that.
Well, we just see these differences in the insula that are associated with that. I think our sample size is a little bit too small to really start looking at broad differences between individuals. Mm-hmm. But these are questions that could certainly be answered if we were motivated to do so.
So you have plenty to study, is what you're saying.
So many questions. I mean, the precise circuits, you know, the nucleus accumbens is not just about dopamine, but oxytocin, serotonin, opioids, all of those intersect right there. And we could tease out exactly which circuits are involved. Those are answerable questions.
We're heading to a part of the program where we're going to talk about healing. What kind of insights? I know you were getting at something different, but what insights are you seeing in your research that may help people like Eric Vance, who's studying how the brain sort of heals? What are you learning with that? Anything?
Well, we start to get into mechanisms that might be how we come to believe what we come to believe. So when you think about pairing doctrinal ideas with reward circuits, you know, that raises the question, how much conditioning is there or associative learning? And do these mechanisms actually contribute towards development and maintenance of religious beliefs?
Dr. Jeffrey Anderson, he's a neuroradiologist here at the University of Utah, part of the Religious Brain Project, along with Michael Ferguson and others. You mentioned some of those other names. You can find all of those names. We'll put a link to that on our website. It was just published in the journal Social Neuroscience. Dr. Anderson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are exploring the relationship between religious faith and feeling and the human brain. Researchers at the University of Utah have started this religious brain study project, trying to figure out what happens in the brain when people have these spiritual experiences. Joining us now on the program is the science journalist Eric Vance, who has written the cover article for this month's National Geographic that asks whether faith can heal a person. He's also the author of the book Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. Eric Vance, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I want to begin, if it's okay, as you do in your book, with your personal experience. So let's begin with that story. Is that all right with you, by the way?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to begin with that story you tell in the book, where you tell of this young child in a family of Christian scientists healed by faith and prayer. And this turns out to be you, of course, in the telling of the story. Mm-hmm. Would you tell about this experience?
Sure. Well, I mean, everyone's faith experiences as a young person is different. But in Christian Science, it's really tied to healing. And healing is a really big part of the religion and how people, your last guest talked about maintaining or creating devotion and their faith. Like, it's, for Christian Science, a lot of that is around healing, and they call it demonstrating. So, and for me, I was actually too young to remember this. Yeah. So that's another interesting twist in this whole story. But
you heard the story a million times. As you said, yes. They told you the story time and time again. Yeah.
And that's almost the more important part for my interest is sort of my perception of what happened. But as I understand it, I had a disease that it caused me to turn colors and my eyes roll back in my head, and there was some coughing. Regardless of what it was a very serious disease, potentially lethal, and my parents believed it was Legionnaire's disease. And they didn't go to a doctor, and I got worse and worse. And then at one point, there seemed to be a real turning point, and it looked to them like I was passing away. Yeah. And they considered going to the hospital at that point, and my mom gave one more call to one of the Christian Science healers and asked for help, and that the healer helped her sort of get to a place of calm, a sort of intense place of calm and confidence, and she walked back in the room, and I had been healed. Yeah. And that's... that's a powerful thing to tell a little kid that happened to them when they were, you know, as you're growing up.
Well, I want to sort of focus on that moment that you write about. Mm-hmm. Because your mother says to this healer that she's on the phone with, I don't know if this religion works or not, but it damn well better work now. I'm losing my son. So there's this kind, like the stakes couldn't be higher.
Right.
And she, as opposed to going to the hospital, she turns around, as you say, and relies on her faith. Mm-hmm. And you write this in the book. You write, unless you have lived in a community of people who place their lives in the hands of their faith, it's hard to understand what it means to break from the building principle, to admit what you've spent your life believing isn't working. Like, this is a really critical moment, and I'm wondering how that moment fits into what you're learning about all of this.
It is, They call them demonstrations in the religion because it is about demonstrating and reaffirming your faith. And to walk away from that, first of all, you know, it's scary going to a hospital for someone who's never been. And it's also, you know, there's also community wrapped around that. And so it would be sort of turning your back. I mean, it would feel like turning your back on everything that you've been raised with. And I certainly felt pieces of that when I left the religion in my 20s. And there was, you know, all the guilt and everything that goes along with it. Mm. But for that moment and for growing up, that really created, I think, a lot of fuel for my parents to believe that, you know, that they were raising their kid in the best way, the most healthiest way they could. And that's an important key to a lot of this, is that people who, whether it's Christian Science or homeopathy or, you know, the thousands of different alternative ways of using health, belief-related health that I talk about in the book, these people aren't crazy. They are giving the best care that they believe they can to their children and to themselves. I mean, people don't purposefully go out and use bad health care. And for me as a kid, it was it created a lot of expectation, which the psychologist would call it, expectation, belief that I had access to this. You know, I had been healed by God. That meant I had some power in my corner. Right. That was a big deal for a little kid.
Yeah, you've talked about how and this seems like an important insight in the book, because even though you left the faith, as you say, in your 20s, there's still a kind of affection for, you're not superstitious necessarily, but you have a kind of respect for what's going on. You say people who believe they're healed are not lying, and they're not fooling themselves.
Well, I certainly hope I'm not superstitious, since I do get cursed by a witch doctor.
Right. Exactly.
So that was. I was glad I was not superstitious at that point. Yeah. But I do have a lot of respect, and my takeaway from all of this is not, oh, it's this or it's that. My takeaway, and anyone's takeaway, should be, wait, what is this? It should be the questioning of this stuff. This is really happening. What is it? And I think we're, as Dr. Anderson was saying previously, I think we're getting some tools to start answering these questions. As you point out, I'm more interested in sort of the bodily response to these things. Mm-hmm. But in both cases, the tools are getting to the point where we can start asking that question of what is going on, and that's what I really that's where and I do have a lot of respect, because it's not just Christian Science, but anyone who uses belief as part of their healing offers this wonderful window into how our mind and body are connected.
Let's start with something you just mentioned a moment ago, and that's expectation, because this seems like I think you describe it in the book as kind of the key idea really to all of this. Mm-hmm. Explain what you mean by expectation, because you say in the book that basically our brains are wired to build these expectations really throughout our lives. Expectations are critical.
Yeah, I mean, it's smarter people than me have said this. You know, your brain is a prediction machine, and people who, some of the founders of sort of artificial intelligence and people who really thought deeply on this, they all say the same thing. It's just, if you can boil down what your brain does to one thing, it's making predictions. And these are small predictions, like when I drop a rock, it'll hit the ground, to bigger predictions, like the hunting will be good on the plains this summer. I mean, these are, you know, your brain makes predictions all day long, all over the place. And these predictions could be described as creating expectations. And what happens is when these predictions are made, these expectations are created, and then they're reinforced. And your last guest talked about classical conditioning, mm-hmm. you know, but there's lots of different ways to reinforce an expectation. We can do it through storytelling, and conditioning is certainly one. Once it gets reinforced, it doesn't want to be wrong. Your brain doesn't want to be wrong. And so it will bend the rules to make its expectation meet reality. And that's really where what I study in the book really, really comes out. And that's what placebos are. That's what a lot of these things are. It's your brain not wanting to be wrong, so it bends the rules in order to make what it believes should happen, happen.
Let's talk about Natalie Grahams.
Okay.
She's and I just want to recommend the book because you tell these stories throughout that give us a sense of these particular elements of it. And Natalie Grahams, she was this German medical student who I'd say has this fascinating experience with homeopathy. I mean, she's on one hand a doctor, but she has this experience. Tell this story, if you would, because this
sure.
really is interesting about how placebo works.
Well, I love this story, and I love that Natalie was willing to share it with me because and she's German, and that's not by accident. Germany is the birthplace of homeopathy, yeah. and what she is, she was a doctor, and she was sort of living the fast-paced sort of, you know, patients are not people, they're symptoms kind of world that young doctors often find themselves in. You know, you got 10 minutes, you got to do your thing. And she wasn't satisfied. And then she got in a car wreck that had lasting problems. And those problems, you might call them sort of nervous breakdown or different kinds of PTSD. And for a lot of us, we think, oh, it's just all in your head. But what I've found is that, you know, those kind of conditions are just as real as, you know, chronic pain and these other things that we think of as being more real. All of these things have this complex relationship between the mind and the body. And she basically, she couldn't work anymore because she was unable to predict when these fits would come on. And it was terrible. And she tried all kinds of medicine. She tried all kinds of anti-anxiety meds and all kinds of doctors. And it just didn't work out. And where she found her relief eventually was actually from a homeopath. And so she got into homeopathy, eventually became a homeopath herself. And found it to be a very powerful tool. And eventually wanted to write a book about, you know, basically speaking to her former self about the benefits of homeopathy. And in writing that book, she realized that homeopathy was mostly placebo,
yeah.
and fell out with the homeopathy community. So she had this sort of movement into this world, and then she fell away from it when she saw the evidence. So she's stuck in between.
Yeah.
There's something going on, but it couldn't be separated from the placebo effect, which, of course, brings up the question of what the placebo effect is. And there she sort of sits, you know, in between these yeah. two worlds. And I think something happened to her. She healed herself, clearly. And yet she had other patients with cancer who did not heal right. themselves. Right. And that's an important part to all this, is that there are rules and there are mechanisms at work, and they work with some things and not with others.
But that seems like one of the key themes of the book is you write that somewhere between expectation and reality is the mind's power to heal itself. You've got to find that mm-hmm. spot somewhere in the middle of all of that. And I guess that's what she did, at least for a time.
She did, and she still does. She's actually working right now, sort of in this world of Germany, they're much more comfortable with these kind of ideas than I think we are in the United States. In this world of sort of mental medicine and the mental repercussions, and this covers everything from the way that you present medicine, the way that you speak to people. I mean, when she was a homeopath, she would spend hours with her patients, sort of trying to understand what their backgrounds were and what was causing their illness, and really getting to the heart of their illness, which makes a completely different health experience for the patient. When, you know, there's hours and there's almost psychotherapy, you know, when you can have that experience, it creates a lot more expectation, a lot more belief, a lot more confidence of being cared for. That is so crucial to getting the brain to create an expectation that it will then step in and make reality.
Eric Vance is with us. He's a science writer and reporter. His article, The Healing Power of Faith, is the cover story for this month's National Geographic. He's also the author of the book Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. We have links to all that, by the way, on our website. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the brain's ability to, well, as the subtitle to Eric Vance's book puts it, to deceive, to transform, and to heal. This book is called Suggestible You. He's also written the cover story for this month's National Geographic. Eric Vance is joining us from NPR in Washington. I didn't realize that I sort of thought that the sense of placebo was kind of a modern concept, but you talk about how ancient the idea is. Hippocrates knew of some kind of placebo effect.
Yeah, and you, I mean, you can go all the way back to Imhotep in Egypt, who was, you know, he was really the first one who said, well, maybe disease is in the body. Maybe we should understand the body at all. And of course, you know, and Hippocrates said, you know, maybe it's not the gods that are doing the healing. Maybe it's if we leave someone alone, their body will heal themselves. And you're seeing this progression. Each one of these people is trying to separate active therapy from what your body does by itself. And in one case, one doctor might be prescribing the by itself, another one might be prescribing the active care. But you see this being a theme that goes back in the history of medicine, is trying to figure out whether when you do something, is it working or is it the person? And my favorite case of this is Mesmer, and he was actually. He was mesmerizing or like magnetizing water and giving it to people and they'd feel better. And it was actually Benjamin Franklin and a few other French scientists who did one of the first placebo-controlled trials and sort of showed that he people were fooling themselves and still having these incredible responses. And what's interesting is throughout that history, as soon as someone is shown to be sort of fooling themselves, they're sort of written off. And no one really spent enough time to ask, well, then what's happening in those people?
Right.
Like, you can't just throw them out the window. What did happen?
I want to ask about your experience in Veracruz with the Brujos of Catemaco. I think what's fascinating about this story, you go there to have your spirit cleansed, basically, and I'll have you sort of explain what happens. But what I think is so interesting about this, and this gets to a really important theme in the book, is that the idea of their being a story and the idea of stagecraft, like the theater of the experience, is also really important in the scheme of things. Take us back to the Brujos, where you in Veracruz, if you would.
Well, this is a concept that a lot of people who study placebos and belief and other realms in this world, in this scientific world that we're talking about, they talk a lot about the theater of medicine, and that there's a theater, and that we have these cues, often subconscious cues that we're noticing around us that are telling us that we should expect some healing. And so I actually went to Catemaco searching for sort of the exotic, bizarre. I was told stories of giant sort of fireballs and people spitting on you and crazy dances and lots of feathers. And that's what I was looking for for theater, because I sort of wanted to look at different kinds of theater as opposed to guy in a white lab coat, you know, PhD behind him, and my favorite Western theater, which is the poster of a human body without the skin on or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like the doctor doesn't need that. He doesn't need to check to make sure where everything is. Right. It's there to tell us that you're going to be, you know, that this person knows what he's doing. And when I got there, and I met with the brujas. First of all, I saw some of the other kinds, and they're really there for, you know, this sort of exotic brujos were there really for the tourists only.
Right.
And the people in town, they actually used a different group of brujos, the witch doctors. And when I finally got to meet with them, and I met with one of the leader of the council and had him do the cleaning of my spirit, he looked a lot like a Western doctor. He wore a white coat. And he had things up on the wall behind him that were they weren't diplomas, but they sort of gave you that feeling of confidence. He had it was very antiseptic in his office. He had a waiting room with, you know, little charms lined up along little stacked neatly, and it felt very much like a doctor. Even smelled like a doctor's office.
Yeah. More clinical than ceremonial, you say.
Much more. Yeah, yeah. And I was so at the first I was so disappointed and confused when I walked out until I realized. That is the theater that works there now. Since the people who I had talked to before I left, and when I went, that what had happened in between was really an acceptance of Western medicine, the arrival of Western medicine, and the reliance on Western medicine. Everyone in town now goes to doctors. So the brujos have changed too, because they rely on creating expectation. They rely on this theater of medicine, mm-hmm. and so they had to change the theater to match with the times, and it had changed so well that I didn't even really notice it. I thought, oh man, this is so disappointing, until you realize that that is how they create confidence now. And they know that better than anyone else, and they have adapted seamlessly.
The storytelling part is really interesting too. The idea that, and you've mentioned that in a number of these cases where you've talked to healers, in one case, another Christian Science healer, one thing you noticed was even though you didn't agree with their conclusions about science, you know, one of the healer you spoke with, for example, said, look, we don't think that there's something biological or physiological going on. This is God's will. This is, you know, God's power being, you know, working through someone's faith. That's what's going on. Even though you didn't agree with them, you found their kind of bedside manner appealing. And they always talked personally and always looked to extract, as you say, the story. How important is that in this thing?
Hugely. Storytelling actually runs throughout the whole book. You know, and I don't just do placebos. I talk about hypnosis. I talk about false memories. And throughout all of it and all of suggestibility, you see storytelling. And I'm, you know, I mentioned before that, you know, you have new classical conditioning where, you know, you just do something again and again and again until someone realizes that maybe one color means more pain or whatever. But the other way you can do it is through really vivid storytelling and telling this tale like, you know, and doctors do this too. When you talk about this, you know, the T cells in your body like soldiers and they're going to attack the invading virus and it's a story. And the more vivid they can be, the more confidence that you get. And and this is a huge part of this the realm between the healing you experience and the healing that's actually caused by the treatment that you're taking. And in Christian Science, as in many of the alternative forms of therapy that I looked at, these people are very good at this, and I think deserve some respect for that. I mean, the practitioner I talked to at the end, Christian Science practitioner is what they're called, she was incredibly comforting, and I just wanted to hang out with her all day because she had this great sort of confidence and soothing presence about her that, man, if my doctor had that, I would never leave that person.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask about, there's a story you tell in the National Geographic article about Mike Politich.
Mm-hmm. Politich.
His story is remarkable because he has Parkinson's, and he goes through this study where he, well, I want you to tell it, where he thinks he's getting surgery. I mean, brain surgery, basically.
Yeah.
And it has an effect. It seems to help him. Yet it turns out that's what had happened was he had been given the placebo, and it's I don't know, talk about this story, because this is really interesting.
Well, briefly, I mean, I talked about the theater of medicine. Yeah. This is one of those incredible theaters of medicine that Western medicine offers. And he early onset Parkinson's, and he was he signed up for this trial, and a portion of the people would get injected. They get this chemical injected into their brain that would hopefully re-trigger this deep part of the substantia nigra to sort of kick back into gear, almost like jump-starting a car. And the other people would get just a couple divots drilled in their head so that they would feel like they had gotten a surgery, but they actually hadn't gotten anything. And both of them would get a tremendous amount of attention, you know, during the course of the study, because no one really knew who got what, and so everyone got a lot of attention. You went into the doctors a lot. You were cared for, and throughout this process, you know, Mike had an incredible recovery from Parkinson's, almost to the point where his doctor felt like they might have even cured Parkinson's. I mean, just shocking. He was heli-skiing by the end of this, getting out of a helicopter and going skiing down these powder runs when before he had had trouble walking. And so when it failed, it was shocking. When the trial failed, it was very shocking for his doctor, because this meant – and it failed because the placebo effect was too high to prove that the therapy had worked. Right. And it was crushing for his doctor until she unblinded – her experiment, got to see who got what, and she realized that Mike had gotten the placebo and that his recovery had been completely self-generated. And for him, it was also a big shock and a lot to take in, to know that this, you know, this thing that you believe changed your life actually came from inside of you. Mm-hmm. And people call it the internal pharmacy, and we do have access to an incredible number of drugs, and there's a big question of who has more access, who has the easiest access to these drugs, but they are there in all of us, and your brain can treat itself with real drugs. Your last guest mentioned opioids and dopamine. And these are drugs that we have in storehouses inside of our brain, waiting to be released. Usually in concert with expectation. And so it was a hard thing for him to wrap his mind around, but he's doing great now, and a lot of it's because he decided that this came from him and he would keep it going.
But what if you're not a believer? What happens? What if you don't believe? What if you're not, you know, not just skeptical, you're an atheist. You don't believe in any kind of supernatural force. How does that sort of turn the story?
Well, I mean, belief is wider than just religion. For me, as a former Christian Scientist, of course, when I talk about belief, when I talk about healing, I can't help but go back to religion, because that's the way I was raised, and the two will always be linked in my mind. But it is wider. I mean, is going to the doctor a religious experience? You know, you are putting your faith in someone, and there are some of these same effects that come out, you know, or people who go to homeopaths or you know, Reiki massage. Like these are vaguely spiritual, but they're also, you know, people searching for relief, and some of that same relief that people get from going to their church. So this isn't necessarily limited. It does, and this is something we all do. Yeah. All of us are suggestible. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is a lot of this stuff is unconscious. And I know some pain doctors who will often, you know, when dealing with chronic pain, one of the first things they'll say is, you know, if you're a lapsed Catholic or a lapsed religious person, think about going back to church, you know, not necessarily to find God, but to find some sense of the subtle cues that will help you get confidence that you will get better or that this is manageable. And there's a lot of subtle cues that are all around us when you go to a doctor's office or when you go to church that tell us that things are okay, and you can't consciously process them. They're happening beyond your reach. So this is something we all do. No one's immune to it, and no one's got no one's got exclusive control of it. It's just something that's really very unifying for all of humanity. I mean, we all have our little thing that creates confidence in us. It could be small or it could be big.
You tell the story of when your sort of religious perspective changed. You're 18 years old. You sort of went on this extreme sports kick, and you went climbing at Yosemite. Mm-hmm. Had this terrifying experience on the side of a cliff with, in a massive thunder lightning storm. But it was this moment when you said you tried everything, you know, even whimpering, you said, but then you prayed. And you write about that moment where you felt nothing. Yeah. Nothing, you say, but your heartbeat and the knowledge that your fate was in your own hands. Would you say something about that? Because that sort of is where you, I think the journey for you to try to figure this stuff out started.
Yeah, looking back, it all seems so clear. At the time, of course, it was a moment of incredible chaos. Yeah. You know, I've talked to many religious people who say, you know, that God helps them find a parking space, that God helps them pick out their tie. And when someone says that they feel the presence of God and they help them pick out that tie, I don't argue with that. I mean, if you said you felt it, then you felt it and it was there. In that moment, when I was hanging off, I don't know, it's called a hanging belay. It's basically a couple of bolts stuck into a sheer cliff, you know, with nothing on your feet. You're just sort of dangling there, and the rain's coming down, and the lightning is striking, you know, nearby peaks, and you just know that any moment you're about to die. And I did. I reached out to God, and I felt nothing. I was really looking for comfort, and I didn't feel it, and I survived. We ended up getting up, and then you have to do the Tyrolean Traverse. You have to, like, literally cross this giant gap on just a rope that connects the spire to the wall. So it's sort of a little spider going across a line. And it's not the way you want to be traveling during a lightning storm. But I did survive. And someone might say that God helped me survive, but I didn't feel it. So, you know, if someone finds a parking space and feels God, well, that's valid, and that's, we should respect that. But if someone survives a lightning storm and doesn't feel him, well, that's equally valid. And so it kind of, I felt a little left alone at that point.
It's Eric Vance. His book is called Suggestible You. He also wrote the cover story for this month's National Geographic. It's called The Healing Power of Faith. You can find links to all of that on our website. Eric Vance, thanks very much for taking the time.
Oh, thanks for having me. This has been really great.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.